and I can't take 7 years to go through processes to make decisions.
UA President Jim Johnson addresses lawmakers after a no-confidence vote from Fairbanks and Anchorage faculty. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, February 8th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Presbyterian Church admits to problems in its Alaska history.
We are apologizing for what we have done, even with some of the good intentions.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Artists, show us how you inspire Alaska. Apply now for an individual artist award. Deadline is March 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org/IAA. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
University of Alaska President Jim Johnson addressed state lawmakers this morning following no-confidence votes by faculty senates at the Anchorage and Fairbanks campuses. After absorbing more than $50 million in budget cuts over the last 2 years, Johnson and the Board of Regents are in the process of consolidating the university's administration through what they call the Strategic Pathways Program. So far, more than 900 positions have been eliminated. The no-confidence votes came after Johnson reversed his recommendation to headquarter the School of Education in Fairbanks after the city and borough of Juneau offered a $1 million contribution to support the school. The faculties felt excluded from that decision and others. Senator Gary Stevens raised the School of Education issue in today's Senate Education Committee meeting.
He made the right decision on moving the School of Education headquarters here to the Juneau campus, but still in all, as a former faculty member, I am quite concerned of where you're going in relationship to the faculty. How are you going to bring them into the process? They apparently feel they've been left out, but how are you going to bridge that gap?
Johnson responded that 89 faculty have been involved in the Strategic Pathways process thus far, and there will be more involvement in the next phase.
Going forward, there will be two rounds of consultation with every affected organizational unit. In addition to that, we're scheduling time with the faculty senates themselves so that they have an opportunity to weigh in. You know, change is very, very difficult, and you've given us budgets that are tough to meet, and I can't take 7 years to go through processes to make decisions about how we're going to move forward. We have to make those decisions expeditiously.
Johnson is scheduled to talk about the university's recruitment strategy, the land grant deficit, and other issues on Thursday at 4:30 in the Senate Finance Subcommittee meeting. State Supreme Court Chief Justice Craig Stowers says Alaska's courts are leading in cutting costs in a way that doesn't threaten vital services. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports on the annual State of the Judiciary address Stowers gave today.
Chief Justice Stowers told lawmakers this legislature has a chance to be remembered by history for addressing the state's fiscal crisis. He says much is similar to the options they faced last year.
But things are different today in the sense that you have, Alaska has, less time to find a way forward to an effective and fair solution to the financial challenges we face.
Stowers says it's not his place to advise legislators on how to address the state's budget, but he urged them to collaborate and compromise.
The stark reality is that Alaska is quickly depleting its savings. New revenue is going to be very difficult to generate. Relying solely on cutting state government will not solve the problem. Postponing hard decisions will needlessly squander what time remains. And there is great controversy about all of the options that you face.
The court has proposed cutting its $105 million budget by $3.5 million. Combined with cuts this year and last, it would have reduced costs by $11 million over 3 years.
It is doable, and it will not inflict long-term damage or disruption to the court's core functions. Our strategy is to make careful, incremental reductions over time. These kinds of reductions are more manageable, and they allow for greater predictability and continuity of core court operations.
Stowers says the courts plan to leave 10 of 690 positions unfilled this year, and the courts aren't filling vacant magistrate judge positions in rural courts. Stowers notes these rural courts are the face of state government in some communities, but he says the judges have very small caseloads compared with other courts. The cases would be heard either by a judge who will periodically travel to rural areas or at a different court, with parties appearing by phone or video link if they can't attend in person. Court workers took a 4% pay cut last year when the courts began closing on Friday afternoons. Stowers says he's concerned about the effect of those cuts.
This salary reduction, when added to the upcoming significant increase in employee contributions to health care coverage, is a true hardship that those earning more money may not fully appreciate. Many of our employees are clerical employees at or near the bottom of the state pay scales. Some have to work several jobs to make ends meet for their families.
The Chief Justice notes some areas where the courts have expanded services, including training workers and lawyers on the overhaul of the state's criminal justice system. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
For a few minutes today, the state House floor started to sound like Britain's House of Commons. The chaos erupted after members of the House Resources Committee released their much-anticipated bill, proposing another round of oil tax credit reforms. Or at least five members of the committee did. Four of them, members of the House Minority Republican Party, say they were never consulted. Here's Anchorage Republican Chris Birch.
In no time was this bill brought before us. As a matter of fact, it was actually presented to the media. And if consensus was achieved, it was done in a secret meeting. That is not transparent.
Birch expressed frustration over the lack of review.
And I typically, in my experience as a committee member, I would be given the opportunity to review the bill before it would be shared with the press.
And for at least half an hour, members of the House Minority and Majority Caucuses argued over whose names should be on the bill, how it should be introduced, decorum in debating motions, and nearly everything that can be fought over besides the content of the bill. And that debate is likely going to continue because in its current form, the bill packs a punch. It cuts net operating loss credits from 35% to 15%, and it limits the ability of companies to earn those credits if they're producing more than 15,000 barrels of oil per day. This is a big deal for some smaller oil companies. Armstrong Energy and Kalis Energy, two smaller producers on the North Slope, say those net operating loss credits are a big concern for them this session. The bill also eliminates the state's credit repurchasing program in 2018. That program has gotten a lot of attention in the last 2 years because Governor Bill Walker has vetoed millions in payments the state already owes to companies under that program. The state estimates it will owe oil companies about $650 million by June. The bill also raises the state's minimum tax from 4% to 5%, and it hardens the floor. When lawmakers refer to the floor in the oil tax credit discussion, they're talking about credits that companies can take that allow them to dip below the state's 4% minimum tax rate. Anchorage Democrat Garen Tarr, who chairs the House Resources Committee, says there will be plenty of time to debate the bill.
We consider this just a starting point. For anyone who's followed oil and gas issues over the last few years, you know that many, many hearings is generally several dozen hearings. So I anticipate that will be, you know, what happens this year as well, that we will have ample opportunity for industry, for concerned Alaskans to hear from the administration.
But if the debate over how the bill was introduced is any indicator, the debate over what it does could be deafening. The company building the Dakota Access Oil Pipeline says it plans to resume work immediately to finish the project. Dallas-based Energy Transfer Partners on Wednesday got final permission from the Army Corps to proceed with the crossing of the Missouri River in southern North Dakota. The work on the $3.8 billion project had been stalled for months due to opposition by the Standing Rock Sioux, but President Donald Trump last month instructed the Army Corps of Engineers to advance pipeline construction. The tribe fears a pipeline leak could contaminate its drinking water. ETP says the pipeline is safe. Company CEO Kelsey Warren has said it will take about 3 months to finish the river crossing. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Home But Not Less, a play about homelessness debuts tomorrow in Anchorage.
This isn't about being sad about our neighbor's situation.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
At 7:30 this evening in Utqiagvik, an apology from the leaders of the Presbyterian Church will be offered to the Alaska Native people of the North Slope. The idea is to start a process of healing by acknowledging that the church, however well-intended, was wrong when it denounced the cultures of Native people, both in Alaska and across the nation. Reverend Joe Reed is the pastor for the Utqiagvik Presbyterian Church. It's the oldest on the North Slope and shares the name of the community formerly known as Barrow. Reverend Reed says a vote by National Church leaders in June was unanimous that an apology was needed.
And I suggested that we ought to invite the stated clerk so that we could be the first to have them come up and do this apology in Alaska, to Alaska Natives.
The stated clerk is the top administrator and spokesperson for the church. Reverend Kurt Carnes is the executive for the Presbytery of the Yukon, a region that stretches from Anchorage to the north. Carnes gave an apology at AFN last fall. He says the wrong started with a 16th century action called the Doctrine of Discovery, a manifest destiny type document that gave churches the right to take land from non-Christian people and sell it to other Christians. Along with land exploitation came the exploitation of the original people who lived there. He says when the churches came to Alaska, they tried to figure out how to minister in an area so big. Enter Sheldon Jackson, the Presbyterian Director for Missions in the West.
He organized a conference of Protestant leaders from across the country, and they really did. They just divided up and said, Lutherans will go there, and Methodists will go here, and Covenant Church over there, and they just divided it up.
Reverend Carnes says they wanted to do good things, but they came with the assumption that being Christian meant becoming more Europeanized. And he says that superiority attitude is at the heart of the apology.
That's the kind of thing that leads to racist attitudes, that leads to cultural paternalism. That's the kind of thing that we're apologizing for. And there were specific things that happened in terms of teaching people that their culture, that their language was, they need to learn English, you can't speak your language. There was one missionary who went so far as to say that the native languages were so heathen you couldn't put Christian thought into it. That kind of thinking is so unchristian that we have to apologize for it. We still deal with racism. We still deal with cultural paternalism. We're not done with that today.
During the Presbyterians' meeting in June, another historic event took place. In addition to the vote to apologize and denounce the concept of the Doctrine of Discovery, the church made the first African-American reverend the new stated clerk. J. Herbert Nelson II is in Utqiagvik to make the apology this evening.
We are apologizing for what we have done, even with some of the good intentions that those who started schools in Alaska had. We were wrong. And I think that frees us to some degree, but it also frees those who have carried the burdens and who are seeing many current-day problems, particularly with families, resulting in some tragic responses to life in this present day.
Lucy Apotiki is from Gamble on St. Lawrence Island. She is a former lay pastor, and she chokes back tears as she talks about the church doctrine that ripped her community apart.
And we came against resistance from our own people within the church. And because of that, we researched why that was. The first Christians in our community were told that our drumming and dancing were evil. It was like they were indoctrinated to believe that the drum and dancing were evil.
She says tonight's apology is a huge step toward healing and coming together to respect the integrity of Native cultures within the church. For most of the past 20 years, Alaska Congressman Don Young has been either a committee or subcommittee chairman, but these days he wields no gavel. Spokesman Matt Shukaro says Young reached the end of a six-year term as chairman of the Subcommittee on Indian, Insular, and Alaska Native Affairs.
House and Senate Republicans instituted a
a term limit on committee chairmanship or leadership roles in 1994. So that's kind of the nature of where we're at.
Young will continue to be a member of the House Transportation Committee and the Resources Committee, two panels he used to chair. In addition, Shukarow says, Young has been named Chairman Emeritus of the Resources Committee. That's a special title created for Young, and Shukarow says it means he can participate in any of the subcommittees.
He certainly looks forward to all the opportunities and certainly feels like he can be even a more powerful voice for Alaska by being able to serve on all those five subcommittees. You know, it's a unique role.
Shukarow says the appointment will allow Young to play a leading role in renewing the Magnuson-Stevens Act, the law governing fisheries management. The spokesman says he didn't know if Young sought a chairmanship this term or whether he would vie for one in the future. Fairbanks High School seniors scheduled to graduate this spring won't need to take a college entrance exam. At its meeting last night, the Fairbanks North Star Borough School Board revamped its graduation requirements. As KUAC's Robert Hannon reports, the board also heard from some educators unhappy with the district's new personalized learning model.
Last summer, state lawmakers repealed a requirement that high school students take the ACT, SAT or Work Keys tests before graduating. The move was meant to cut costs, and several school districts also dropped the requirement. Fairbanks administrators wanted to follow suit. They say retaining the graduation tests would pose logistic and fiscal hurdles. But at last night's meeting, school board member Mike O'Brien observed the hurdles only get higher once a high schooler graduates without taking the tests.
And now they really need the work keys, and now there's no one there to help them get there.
Ultimately, O'Brien was the only school board member to vote against jettisoning the tests. And in other actions, the board rescinded related graduation policies and requirements. While it wasn't on the agenda, several educators like West Valley science teacher Gregory Cahoe expressed dismay at the district's recent award to a new software vendor for the personalized learning program.
Education Elements is a tech-based startup company with a short history and no independent record of success.
Cahoe says teachers already deliver personalized learning to students with existing software. While she didn't directly address Cahoe's remarks, Superintendent Karen Gaborik did report on recent training elementary school educators received on personalized learning. She says she and her communication team will work on briefing secondary school teachers on the program and what they can expect.
Remember, middle school is the next phase, and they'll begin in the fall, and then high school, though, not till next January.
Gaborik reported elementary school teachers seem to like the new program. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
A new play in Anchorage this weekend tells stories of homelessness from around the state. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman learned that Home But Not Less isn't a story about sadness, it's about understanding.
Rumpled tarps hang against the walls of an old church, serving as backdrops for the eight actors that circle the audience's seating area.
So many of us live on the edge.
One medical incident.
One paycheck.
The lines are just snippets from over 100 interviews with people who have experienced homelessness and those who offer them services. Playwright Mary Ellefson began researching the play after meeting a young man who was living on the street and grieving the loss of his grandfather. She was hoping to understand not just what it was like to be without a home, but also what are the causes of homelessness in Alaska. She says everyone's story starts in a different place.
If I'm sitting underneath a bridge and talking to someone who his parents were encouraging him to drink at age 2 and laughing, his life trajectory is going to be a lot different than mine for a lot of different reasons.
Through her conversations, Ellefson says she identified what her interviewees see as some of the major causes of homelessness.
Mental illness, housing, poverty, how they're related, how they're not related. Racism and discrimination plays a huge part of this. Education, sexual abuse, domestic violence.
Many community leaders say racist policies, such as forcing Alaska Natives to attend boarding schools where they were punished for speaking their languages, caused many people to lose their identities. It led to intergenerational trauma, which some people Ellefson spoke with link to causes of homelessness. Actor Austin Tagaban learned about some of these causes by participating in the production. He says he's never worried about being homeless.
If I didn't have somewhere to sleep that night, I could call someone and be like, hey man, or hey mom, let me sleep on your couch. And she'd be like, no, have this room, Austin.
He says he thought the answers to homelessness were simple. Why couldn't someone just get a job? But now he understands how complicated people's lives are and how much we can learn from them.
It's important to hear these stories because they're people who we usually ignore.
One of those stories is from Michael Patterson, who first became homeless in Juneau when he was 9 years old. It's told by actor George Holly.
In the mornings, when the stores opened, I would steal fruits off the displays. I lived like a rat, in a sense. So you know my self-worth was, it was destroyed.
For Holly, participating in the play is personal. He says learning about the support networks available to people helped him alleviate some of his own fears. Director Shona Osterhout says that's one of the main ideas of the production, to develop empathy and solutions.
This isn't about being sad about our neighbor's situation. This is actually about, how do I learn about our neighbor's situation? What can I do to help? And how do I just be a better human on the planet?
Each show will be followed by a panel discussion with local service providers. Writer Ellefson says she wants people to leave knowing ways they can get involved. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hellman.
The play starts tomorrow night at the Church of Love on Spinard in Anchorage and will run through the weekend. More information is at our website, alaskapublic.org. New restrictions are being put into place for the upcoming spawn on kelp herring fishery in southeast Alaska to address a declining population. For the first time, fishermen are required to share spawning structures with several others. KFSK's Angela Denning reports.
The spawn on kelp fishery allows fishermen to catch herring near Craig and Kloak and put them into floating net pens called pounds. Blades of kelp are also put in there for the herring to spawn on. The eggs are then sold to Asian markets. Scott Walker is the area management biologist for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Ketchikan. He's been helping to manage the spawn on kelp fishery since it began in 1992.
We have been seeing throughout southeast Alaska right now a downturn of herring stocks.
In the past, the fishermen were restricted by the number of blades of kelp they were allowed to use in their pounds. Now, fishermen will also be forced to share a pen with at least 5 other permit holders. The effort will mean less pounds being used, which is what the state is after, says Walker. Last year, 46 structures were fished. The year before, it was 76, and this year it's limited to 20.
I had to do something. We couldn't do the same thing we did last year. We'd go well over at least double the amount of herring that I can legally allow to be utilized in this fishery. Our hope is that we're going to utilize no more than our gutting harvest level allows.
The quota is 349 tons of herring, and about 20 tons are used per structure, according to the state. The herring are released from the pounds after spawning, but biologists estimate that most of them don't survive. Fishermen can also use open pounds, where the herring can come and go at will to spawn, but they are not as popular among fishermen. The state keeps track of herring stocks through aerial surveys of spawning and dive surveys of deposited eggs. That data is put into a model that estimates how many herring will spawn the following year. So why is the herring population declining? Walker thinks it's likely cyclical and that the population will rebound, but it still has to be addressed this year.
The only other really option we have is to not have a fishery. We can't do business as usual like we did last year because we would catch more herring than we're allowed to catch.
This is the only spawn-on kelp fishery in Southeast again this year. Other fisheries have been closed for the past several years due to low numbers. Petersburg's mayor, Mark Jensen, participates in the spawn-on kelp fishery, and he says he understands that the biologists are concerned about the stocks, but it will likely mean less income for fishermen.
Our state economy is suffering already, and we need to be protective of the stocks, but we need to make sure we're doing it in a manner where we're capitalizing on the highest value for the fishery, in my opinion.
Jensen says it will be interesting to see how fishermen sharing pounds turns out. He says he's told the governor as much.
I said it's hard to get two fishermen to agree on something, and now you're talking about 120 permit holders and 20 pounds. I said, so we'll see how that works.
Fish and Game Scott Walker agrees it will be challenging for fishermen, but says the spawn-on kelp is a complicated fishery anyway. He says there are practically endless variables from catching the fish to transporting the eggs on kelp.
There's nothing easy about the pound fishery. This fishery is, there's 1,000 ways to lose your fishery, to just get your product destroyed.
He hopes that by restricting the fishery this year, it will allow it to continue in the future. Last year, 130 permit holders participated in the Craig Kloak fishery. The fishery opens for purse seining on March 17th. Herring usually spawn between late March and mid-April. Petersburg Vessel Owners Association declined to comment for this story. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
Finally tonight, a correction. A story we ran yesterday about alcohol sales and search and rescue in Bethel stated that a Bethel search and rescue member had often hogtied intoxicated people that he found during searches. He clarified he has never hogtied anyone, but rather he has had to strap intoxicated people to himself to steady them as he transported them on snow machine. BSAR says the organization does not hogtie people. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman, Rasha McChesney, and Caroline Halter in Juneau, Angela Denning in Petersburg, Robert Hannon in Fairbanks, and Ann Hillman in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta Subsistence Regional Advisory Council is meeting in Bethel February 15th and 16th at the AVCP Housing Authority Conference Room from 9 to 5 to develop proposals to change federal subsistence wildlife and trapping regulations for the 2018 to 2020 regulatory years and discuss other issues related to subsistence. The public is encouraged to participate either in person or by teleconference. For all the information about the meetings, go online to doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. Contact the Office of Subsistence Management to receive meeting documents or to request special accommodation needs by 7 business days prior to the meeting. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.